If you want to see examples of what we talked about on the show, check out bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. Don just lost it. Welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. This is episode number 102. Yeah, buddy. Yeah, we made it. I am your host, as usual, the exasperated Dallas Busha. And today, our roundtable consists of...
Don.
Al.
Rook.
Yeah, we got the whole original crew back. The Fab Four. Almost
core
said five.
Four.
The what'd you say?
Core Four.
The Core Four.
Core
yeah,
Four.
Buddy.
The Fantastic Four.
We are the Fantastic Four. Rook is Sue.
What? How the hell does that work? I don't know about this.
Are you going to be She-Hulk?
Hey, Fantastic Four once consisted of Spider-Man, Wolverine, Hulk, and Ghost Rider, so
I'll
go with that incarnation, and I'm Ghost Rider.
Okay, you're Ghost
What's
Rider.
Up?
Who's, I'll be Wolverine because I'm the shortest one here.
Who's the other two?
Hulk and Spider-Man.
Who wants to be the Hulk, you or me?
It's up to you.
I'll be the Hulk. You can be
okay.
Spider-Man.
Well, you guys don't have to be so nice about it.
Yeah. Wow, they sound thrilled.
So, welcome back to the fold, gentlemen. It's nice to have all of us together again.
Together.
I hope you've all been reading tons of comics. I personally have two big fat trade paperbacks that Rook threw down on my lap that I can't wait to go home and read.
Yeah, you better get those read.
Yeah, Lock and Key, volumes 3 and 5. I've read 1, 2, and 4, so I guess I should read those too.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to read those out of order.
Yeah,
you know?
Especially Don and I both read volume 4 of Lock and Key as our introduction to Lock and Key. And as you mentioned on episode, I think, 100, a couple episodes back, you mentioned how it's hard to jump in the middle of the story.
Yeah, it is. It's really a building storyline. So.
I was asking Dallas about that because, one, I'll be honest, Gabriel Rodriguez is a fantastic artist. And I really like... the figures are good. That's what I would look for. But it's how he draws his architecture and stuff. It's really strong work.
Yeah.
And his storytelling is, you know, strong.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what's really funny is Joe Hill is the writer on here.
Yeah.
And I was talking to somebody else about this book, and I was like, oh, man, I'm reading this fantastic book, Lock and Key, da-da-da-da. I'm carrying on and on about it. And the guy goes, oh, yeah, that's Stephen King's son.
Yeah.
I was like, what? No, you must be thinking of something. He goes, no, that's Stephen King's son. It really is. It's Stephen King's son. I had no idea. So it was really, really cool to find out that it was.
It's neat and it makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Al, you've never read it, have you?
No, I didn't know Stephen Joe Hill was Stephen King's son either. Wow.
You'll have to check it out. You'll have to read it.
Yeah, definitely.
But
he was writing comics.
That's a very critically acclaimed book in the first place.
Well, the problem I had with it was I couldn't figure out exactly what was going on to it. It's when later when Rook was explaining it builds up on itself. It does make sense because I was a little, I mean, I could follow it. I shouldn't put it that way. It seemed like there was more than I wasn't figuring out what was going on. My favorite part of that book that, you know, you lent to me was the younger brother was playing with action figures.
Oh, yeah.
And I just thought it was genius because it wasn't like all one set. You know, you had like a giant gorilla, a bunch of little army men. And he's playing all these characters out, and they were showing what he was seeing in his mind. It was all, like, you know, real. But then it kept showing him playing with the figures, and then the sister brought in another boy holding his figures, and she goes, you know, she says, what commandant so-and-so, do you have room to bring this? And you can see the boys holding their figures and really excited.
Yes.
And that was absolutely my favorite part of the thing, and immediately they broke in. I guess one of them had, like, an English accent, real proper.
Yep.
And the other one was like some, you know, rough and tumble American.
Like a sergeant.
Yeah,
Army
sergeant.
Yeah.
And, but I mean, it was like a gorilla with bionics and, you know, a robot or something. I found that genius. But it was a neat story. Again, it was throwing me off some of the, what was going on with it. And I didn't understand the whole concept of the locks and keys, you know, how it took you to other places.
Well, each key has its own properties, and
each key
does something different. And when you read through the series, you find out how the keys were created and what started everything and how the whole key house came to be. So it's really such a fantastic build of a storyline. I'm going to be picking up the last one probably next week when I hit the shop again.
It's a real slow burn, too.
Oh, yeah.
How far does it go in trades?
6.
The story's complete.
The story is complete.
Oh, okay.
Matter of fact, actually, there's been talk of Fox was going to do a TV show of it.
Okay.
But apparently they decided to pick up what?
Supergirl, right?
No, this was actually like 2 years ago that was supposed to be a TV show. Fox ended up picking up two other properties instead, and both of them failed.
In your face, Fox!
But now I understand that there's actually talk of a movie. A series of movies.
I would hope a series of movies. That would work.
Yeah.
Like actually, CBS is picking up Supergirl for, I don't know, next year, the year after, or
yeah.
Speaking of television shows, have you seen the extended trailer for The Flash?
Oh, yes.
That's going to be fun. Yeah. I like it. It's a different
really,
sensibility.
Really good.
But I love that they keep that, well, some would call it cheesiness, but that
it's
campy. Comic bookish.
I wouldn't call it cheesy. Yes. I would call it campy.
Okay.
Yeah, like Batman.
Yeah. Yeah, like
but
the original Adam West Batman. Yeah.
That's part, yeah, I mean, not quite hugely intentionally camp like that Batman, I would say. But it's, it looks like it's capturing the essence of,
well, yeah,
of a comic book about the Flash.
You have to have a sense of humor in some things. And the Flash always, in the old comic strips, it was serious. But it always had a sense of fun to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, if you think about it, what DC's done, DC has done TV shows brilliantly.
Yeah.
Smallville, Arrow, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And now they're coming out with Flash, Gotham. This new movie that they're talking about, I don't know. We'll see how that goes. But they do TV beautifully.
Yes, I agree.
So I think, in a way, Flash has to be a little bit different than the other shows. Because Flash isn't really a dark character. Arrow, Smallville, you know, those they kind of had some very dark overtones to them.
Right.
You know, and it was very difficult to watch Superman in a dark overtone, but, like, it wasn't Superman. It was Clark becoming Superman.
Right.
You know, and, you know, overall, I'm really looking forward to the series. Gotham looks interesting, too. I mean, I don't really know how well it's going to carry, though. I mean, you're talking about Gotham City.
I feel like it'll
Batman.
Have a strong start, but, I mean, look, that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show... Now, I've never seen it, but it's already on its third season, so there's an audience.
Yeah,
for it.
Second.
Second?
Season.
Oh,
yeah,
screw that.
The show's brilliant. I mean, it's extremely well written. You know, there's little homages and tip of the hats to the fans, to the readers, you know, with different characters that showed up. Deathlok's in the series.
Yeah, Deathlok.
Deathlok looks beautiful. The guy that plays Deathlok is great. And then there was the little X-ray scene where you actually saw the whole Deathlok.
Oh, cool!
You know,
like a half-face thing.
Yeah, the whole Deathlok setup. So this next season is going to be interesting. Absorbing Man. They're talking about having Absorbing Man in the next season.
Wow!
So
that's cool. Well,
you know.
I'm kind of looking forward to oh God, what's her name? Agent Carter.
Yeah,
having her own show. She was one of my favorite characters in the Captain America films.
Yeah. Agent Carter should be interesting.
Well, DC is taking a cue from Marvel finally on their shows, and they're doing some world building, because in the trailer that I saw for The Flash, Arrow was in it,
yeah,
hanging out talking to the
Well,
Flash.
You got to remember, in Smallville, you had Arrow, you had, I think there was a Flash in Smallville.
They had
Cyborg.
The majority of the Justice League.
Yeah, Cyborg was in there. You know, you had this variety pack in Smallville. So Smallville really led into allowing... the expansion of the DC universe. So, you know, as far as movies go, though, DC's got a lot of catching up to do.
It doesn't seem to me like they're that interested in it, though.
The Batman versus Superman.
It seemed like they concentrated on Batman, you know, which the movies were quite popular. But it seems to me like most of the work is the TV stuff is what they're concentrating on. The movies, I don't know.
Animation, DC does.
Yeah.
Animation they do brilliantly.
Yeah,
Young
yeah.
Justice, Justice League Unlimited. You know.
There's another one coming
Teen
out
Titans.
This year.
Teen Titans Go. I mean, the old Teen Titans show I love. This new Teen Titans Go.
Well, what they did was they took what people liked about the Teen Titans show that Glenn McConnell, I guess he does both of them, but basically all they did was just kept all the fart jokes, and that's all the show is.
Pretty much.
You know, there's no story or action like the other
one.
Well,
in the end, that's really all you need, right?
Well, I it's on, because every time I flip the Cartoon Network, they're either showing The World of Gumball, whatever that show is, or...
Adventure Time.
Oh, I like Adventure Time, but
Adventure Time is fun. But I mean, it's just it's I don't know.
You know, my daughter turned me onto that first. I didn't want to like it, and I think that show is absolute genius. And she has the first two seasons, and watching those and how it built up, man, this show's incredible. And then I only watch Cartoon Network when she come home. And after I watched those two seasons, I started watching some of the other ones. And it's just clever. Some of the stuff they... There's one of the later seasons, that dog, Jake, he has to go in a room to save Finn. And there's a painting of a guy on the wall talking to him. And the painting goes all the way down across the floor, and the legs are coming up, you know, where the doorway is, the guy's talking. And he has... It's something like you get these wishes to do this and that. It's just odd, dry humor, and it's just unique. It's like if Salvador Dali designed a cartoon, that's what it would be like.
Yeah. Well, do you remember Ed, Edd n Eddy on Cartoon Network?
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite cartoons was one of their first episodes where they took the outline off of one of the guys.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember what was going on, but basically these three characters are tripping. And they took one of their outlines away.
That's awesome.
You know, that's kind of what Adventure Time reminds me of, is one long episode of that particular episode of Ed, and Eddy.
I love when a cartoon self-awareness plays with a medium like that.
Yeah.
I just remember the old Daffy Duck cartoons where you'd see like the writer's, the painter's hand, and you like erase things and add things in Daffy's world.
You know, speaking of all this, I watched a documentary just last night. I highly, highly recommend this. It's called I Know That Voice. And it's John DiMaggio is the one that put it together. You guys will know him as the voice of Bender the voice of Jake the dog. But it goes through and it talks to all these voice actors, and it talks about the industry, how they got into the industry, what the industry is really about, and I mean it's absolutely fantastic. Netflix, yeah, it's on Netflix right now.
What's it called?
It's called I Know That Voice.
I'll check it out.
Dude, it sounds like a bunch of 5-year-olds are having a keg party out there or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, here this is the drawback to living right by a school. You know. Of course they talk about Daffy Duck being Mel Blanc. They talk about probably one of my favorite episodes ever of Looney Tunes was when Rabbit Season, Duck Season, where Bugs walks in a Daffy costume and does a Daffy Duck impression, and then Daffy walks in a Bugs costume and does Bugs impression. Well, it's the same guy doing both voices.
Yeah, right.
He was literally the man of a thousand voices.
But the best part of this whole thing is he's doing Bugs Bunny's voice as Bugs Bunny is trying to imitate Daffy Duck, and then Daffy Duck is trying to imitate Bugs Bunny's voice. So it's this beautiful, like, brilliant piece of voice acting. Just amazing, amazing stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
is that something they brought up on the documentary?
That's something they brought up on the documentary. I mean, I've always loved that episode, and I've always gotten a kick out of that little scene in that episode. But I never thought about it that way. How absolutely goddamn brilliant he is
doing that.
I mean, you know, that's genius.
He was
really
on the show.
He was on the Jack Benny show.
Yeah, he was on the Jack Benny show, and he just do voices. But he was
he acted in it. He would be, and then he was also on radio too. All those guys were radio. Well, those guys like that were all radio.
Yeah, they all started radio. That's they talk about it. They all started on radio, and then they moved on to the animation and the voice acting and. You know, I forget who it was, but she's talking about how nervous she was her first day on an animation set, and she walks into the recording studio, and there's everybody from radio that she's worked with.
Yeah.
You know,
you know which one is really funny? I watch the reruns of Petticoat Junction. I never realized that the old lady, not the old lady, but the lady who ran it, Kate, she's Betty from the Flintstones, and I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You see a face to the character, and you're like, oh, no. And then I watch another episode, and they said in the credits, Also, you know, guest starring Gene Vanderfill. Gene Vanderfill was Wilma in the cartoon. So actually, the real Betty and Wilma were in this episode of Petticoat Junction. And apparently, in another episode, which I never saw, a guy named Alan Reed was in it. He was Fred Flintstone's voice. So all they needed was Mel Blanc to show up on the show, and they would have the whole Flintstones.
Well, speaking of Mel Blanc, I was just the other day, I was reading a really old issue of Comics Journal. I think one you gave to me.
Probably, maybe.
And it was late 80s, and it was the month that Mel Blanc passed away.
Oh, wow.
So they had a blurb about him, and they were, you know, talking about his work and whatnot. And I think they said his very first voice that he created when he got hired by Warner Brothers was Porky Pig.
Yeah.
Imagine just going in there and suddenly, boom, first thing.
Yeah,
you know, that's so impressive. What an iconic sound! And he created. I don't think Warner Brothers owns him, but Woody Woodpecker was one of his very first that he did.
Yeah.
He created it, and then someone else went on the voice.
Walter Lance was the guy.
Yeah.
No, he's talking about the voice. I'm
sorry, I meant the voice of Woody Woodpecker.
Oh yeah, I knew that, but Walter Lance was.
It ended up being a woman doing the voice.
Yeah, exactly. He created the voice, and then someone else went on to use it.
That's a good documentary.
Well, that's every voice he comes up with is extremely distinct. I mean,
it's not a bunch that sound like each other. You're right.
You can tell it's his voice, but it's a different.
But it's a different.
Like Pepe Le Pew or something like that.
And that's exactly what it's about. It's like, I know that voice. Like, just for example, Hank Azaria. Here's a guy. I mean, seriously, you should look up his IMDb and just, you're going to be scrolling for, like, I looked up on my phone. I had to scroll for a minute to just get past all his credits on The Simpsons. The guy
does more than just Homer.
he does like a ridiculous number of people. He does Mo, he does Chief Wiggums, he does Lou. I mean, he does a ridiculous number of these guys.
Yeah.
And what was funny is when he popped up on the screen, I'm like, okay, I know him from something else. What else is he in? Oh, he's been in like Godzilla. He's been in a whole bunch of different movies, but
Night at the Museum.
The one I love best, though, is he plays he plays in The Birdcage.
Oh,
he's the houseman. he's the butler, the maid in Birdcage.
Hilarious.
Yeah,
he's been in a lot.
When I realized that was him, I was like, oh my god, that's him! Oh, holy crap!
Yeah, he's in those museum movies, and I think he plays like Boris Karloff in it or something. And he does the voice.
That's
perfectly.
Cool.
He's
an impressionist.
You know who else was in A Night at the Museum was Shane from The Walking Dead, that actor.
Really?
He's in, I want to say it was probably the first Night at the Museum. I can't remember because I just saw bits and pieces. But he played like a gangster, and he was actually in black and white. Like, his character walked around in like black and white. Like,
oh, no kidding.
On TV set. Yeah, and
that's
he was like a 1940s gangster.
Did they talk about movie dubbing at all in the, or was it just animation?
Well, I mean, one of the guys does do some movie, like, you know, in
back
a world.
They did
on in a world.
In
you
a
know,
world.
All that stuff. But they also talked about anime.
Yeah,
you know how you have to actually line up the what you're saying with the lip flaps that are already pre-existing.
Yeah.
You know, they talked about how much work there is for voice actors in video games. You know, because they were talking about, you know, a typical day for a voice actor is a 4-hour stint, and you know you have these huge thick scripts, and you know it's okay. We want you to react to being shot. We want you to react to being hit. We want you to react to being blown up. We want you to react to being stabbed. You know, we want you to react from jumping off of a 5-foot fall, a 10-foot fall, a 20-foot fall. You know, and, I mean, it's incredible.
Do you remember?
Absolutely incredible, the amount of work.
Do you remember the incredibly horrible voice acting in a lot of the first gen like PS1 games, like Resident Evil?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
that was classic.
Yeah, it was. I mean, some of the original voice acting for video games was god awful.
Yes.
But if you look at it now, like
it's
I didn't realize this, but Gears of War, John DiMaggio voices the main character for Gears of War.
Huh.
That scratchy voice, you know, as he's talking Delta One, you know, all that. That's him. You know, and then you think about he's also Bender, and he's also Jake the dog. And
but the thing is, when you're talking about these, they don't make a big deal about the people's voice. You learn it because it's awesome.
Yeah.
But I hate it when Don Bluth used to put out those movies like All Dogs Go to Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the title, you know, I mean the preview, and they'd always say, with the voice talents off,
yeah,
and they start naming the actors. Well, that's not why people are going to see the movie.
Yeah, but and that's actually something they talk about. One of the producers for Simpsons is on there, and he goes, I'd rather work with voice actors than, you know, Hollywood actors.
Exactly.
Because, you know, it's, you know, it's just, it's easier.
Well, the other thing is, like, in the Batman animated series, which is one of my favorites, everybody knows Kevin Conroy now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I remember when I was reading about it, before the cartoon came out, it was in Comic Shop News. And they had a whole piece about it, and they started talking about the voice actors. Of course, everybody knew Mark Hamill.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And which
who's
I,
in this documentary as well.
But I was having trouble picturing him as a Joker, but they kept going about Kevin Conroy and how he changes his voice between Batman and Bruce Wayne. Okay, yeah, big deal. His voice actor. Well, now, I mean, he's just fantastic. I love
mm-hmm.
him. But they didn't say Batman with the voice talent, so.
Yeah, and well, and he's.
We just learned it as it
yeah,
went on.
He's in this documentary, too. Absolutely
yeah.
fascinating piece. Really, really is.
Mel Blanc was the voice of the Thing in the original Fantastic Four cartoons.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, man.
And he was also played two of the Beatles in the Beatles cartoons. I think George and
cool.
I think George and John played
know.
Their voices.
Yeah.
I think.
That's the thing. Mel Blanc, everybody knew him. But they never went on about Looney Tunes with the voice talents of. You know?
No.
We just learned it because he was awesome.
Yeah.
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 Animated, that's great stuff.
Big budget animated films these days, like CG films, always have huge actors
yes,
and voice
yes,
talents.
Yes.
And that is how they sell the films.
Yeah.
Which
and
is absurd.
Yes. Well, and one of the points that was made in this is, you know, you have to do an A, a B, and a C take. You have to do an A, a B, and a C take. You have to do an A, a B, and a C take, you know, of the same line. And, you know, you have it's more theatrical. You have to project, you have to be able to project in your voice what these other actors are doing with their voice and their body and their look.
Yeah.
So you have to use that voice. And it's brilliant, brilliant documentary. I mean, just the insight into these
but,
concepts.
But now, I don't know if it was the same way now, but back then you had to actually loop it, like, right at the moment so they could actually capture it. Now with, like, Pro Tools or whatever, you can probably just say it, and they can just kind of sync
well,
it
no,
better.
They still talk about having to sync up the lip flaps.
Oh,
you
they
know.
Still do it live. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so,
wow.
you know, well, and especially with something like anime. You know, because you're looking at something that was pre-done in a foreign language,
wow.
and they're trying to sync up as best as possible,
right.
or exactly, to, well, basically an animated character that's actually speaking a completely different language. So
yeah, but the anime was always lip-flapping. They didn't match up.
Well, yeah, like Speed Racer was anime.
Yeah, but I'm talking about even in Japanese, it
okay.
didn't match up, literally.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
The cartoon, the animated series of Akira, you know, the comic
Oh,
series,
yeah, absolutely.
That was the first one that they actually had the Japanese language and the lip-flapping match up to it. And that was a big thing. Of course, when they brought it here, it was dubbed, and it didn't matter anyway.
Yeah.
But from what I understand, all the anime up to Akira, and I don't know if they do that since, but it was just, it didn't always quite match up to the actual Japanese voices.
Yeah. Well, I think you see a little bit of difference now, because people expect that. It
yeah,
throws
you're
them
right.
off. Like Full Metal Alchemist,
yeah.
Cowboy Bebop, you know, you see a more smoother lineup between the lip movements and the vocals.
Yeah.
So, you know, because it throws you off. It really does. Like, you know, I watch a lot of stuff, you know, streaming online, and if something's wrong with the stream, you know, and the voices aren't lining up with the lip movements, totally throws you off the whole,
yeah,
whole movie.
It does throw you off.
Speaking of flapping lips, Don, you may remember this. I don't know if you guys ever saw it. You ever see these cartoons? One of them's called Clutch Cargo, and another one's called Space Angel. Did you ever see those two from the 60s? This was the weirdest thing they ever designed. It was a cartoon. It was limited animation, but they still moved a little bit and blah blah blah. But instead of like matching lips, what they did was they superimposed a real person's
real
lips,
set of lips,
and they would talk.
Oh,
and whenever
that.
They did a close up, it was
okay.
It's disturbing.
That's good. Now let me do this. Rook Dallas, are you familiar with a show called Space Angel from the 60s?
No.
Yeah.
Well, then your childhood sucked. That show was so awesome. Alex Toth worked
yeah,
on it.
He did.
And,
yeah.
you know, Al puts it down. I mean,
no,
I
don't put it down. It's just creepy when this.
No, I remember, like.
I thought it was the great. They used to show
it
on the TV station in Dallas, Texas. And it was basically, you know, it was extremely limited animation.
Limited, yeah.
But the drawings were beautiful.
Yes.
And basically. What was the guy? Scott McCloud, was that?
From Was it Scott McCloud who talked about it? Or
no, I think, yeah, I know there's a cartoon of Scott McCloud, but I think it was something McCloud.
Doug Wilde worked on it,
yeah,
too.
But Alex Toth was the main illustrator.
Fox? Was it Fox McCloud?
No.
But anyway, he was the Space Angel, but he looked like Nick Fury. He had an eye patch and all that. And he had a female sidekick and a kind of heavy, I guess, doctor with a beard.
The only anime guy I remember with an eye patch was Captain Harlock.
This wasn't anime. This
was
an American show.
American.
And it had a, I guess the closest look would be Johnny Quest, you know, because the same guys kind of worked on it. But they used real humans' lips over it. But as a kid, I never noticed that. But if you ever watched that DVD, that Pixar show, Incredibles, and all the extras, they have an old 50s animation of Frozone and Mr. Incredible with the giant bunny rabbit. And it's kind of neat. When I saw it, my daughter's like, what are you looking at? Well, that's how they used to do shows. And I, you know, in the 50s, they used to show these. I wasn't a kid in the 50s, but you see reruns. But you can also watch that short cartoon with the voice, with the audio commentary, and it's the actors. Whoever played Frozone, what's that man's name? He's real popular. It's not Morgan Freeman. It's the other guy that does a lot of voice work.
I don't know.
Anyway, they're sitting there talking, and the guy I played for, what is this? They made me white. Why do I look like that? What's with these lips? Because they have that lip, you know, the human lips over the figures. And the guy said, it's a new animation technique. It looks stupid. What's that giant rabbit doing there? What's with the lips? It's a new technique to try and out. It's state of the art. It's human lips. That's creeping me out. And it's absolutely hilarious. But yeah, they use the real lips. But as
a kid, Samuel Jackson.
Yeah, Samuel Jackson.
Sam Jackson. Okay.
The other guy.
it's worth buying the DVD. One, The Incredibles is absolutely incredible. It's one of my favorite shows. But it's worth buying the DVD just for all the extras. And when I watched that, I nearly fell out of my seat. You know. Anyway.
I'm going to watch the documentary tonight.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's take a music break, and then we'll come back and talk about some comics.
Bye. You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you want to hear our older episodes, you can find them at our blog on bunchofdorks.com.
And that was Samaria there in Manila, Philippines. And if you're ever in that area, you can go take a look because they're a working band. Anyway, the name of the song is Paano Na Tayo. Paano Na Tayo.
You got that?
Okay.
But, you know, Tagalog is not a language I speak, but my wife was singing along with the chorus when I was listening to the song. Anyway.
She could translate for you.
They're a great band.
Yeah, it's actually really good. I like the singer, too.
Go check some of that out.
Yeah, we heard it. Yeah.
Listen to episode 102. I read an awesome book.
Wait a minute. This is episode 102.
I read an awesome book. Actually, I have to say, I was a champion for the weeks leading up to episode 100. You know, as everybody knows, we took forever to get it out. So I was reading comic books left and right, and then suddenly, Don throws me a book.
Did you actually throw it at him?
No.
I hope not. It's pretty big. Okay. It was a novel. It was an autobiographical novel slash the history of superheroes. It's called Super Gods, and it's by Grant Morrison. And once I got my hands on that, all other reading ceased for like weeks.
Nice.
And I read the hell out of that thing, and I just finished it a few nights ago. And I was completely enamored with it. It was fantastic.
Is it fiction or
No, it's an autobiography of Grant's life.
Oh, is that what it
but
is?
He,
oh,
interesting.
It's intermingled with his kind of take on the history of superhero comics and the idea and the concept of a superhero as like, you know, a modern myth in our culture. Absolutely incredible. Great. And he hits all the major touchstones of superhero comic books throughout the decades. And Don read it too.
You know, it's what's interesting is he tells this whole backstory about how his father was a World War II vet, and then after that they built an American Trident sub base, you know, with nuclear weapons, and his father spent the rest of his life, you know, protesting that. Mm. So he went from a World War II veteran to a hippie.
Huh.
And I forgot, his mother had a unique story too.
The main thing I got from his mother, she was a huge science fiction fan, and she encouraged his art and his comic book reading, and she always pushed him into doing what he wanted, which is great to have a set of parents that were like that.
And like most of his life, when he was growing up under the threat of nuclear Armageddon, he was reading the pamphlets his dad had about all this. And at the same time, like all of us, he's wanted to be an artist. He read comics. They were using comic books as ballast for the ships coming over to the United States. And all through that, he's telling his whole story of how he, you know, picked up guitar, was trying to be a musician when he was a kid, and how he read the comics. And then he started giving his own takes on how it worked, which is what I really enjoyed the most. And then at one point, he's talking about, I guess, in the 80s, they started bringing all the Brits over, you know, doing their takes on the superheroes. And he went into Alan Moore and all these other guys and what they were doing and how it changed and threw everything sideways.
Yeah, it's funny reading and how you can clearly tell he has no love for Alan Moore. They don't get along
with
those guys.
I didn't know that.
Wow.
Just reading between the lines, it really seemed like that.
I got you. Well,
like, he had respect for the guy, but he wasn't a big fan of
the person. But then at one point, he was writing, I guess at the end of the 90s, or it was the 2000s, he said basically the Yanks took all their work back and wanted the Brits to go away. And basically, everybody started doing the, you know, American superheroes in the United States again. And he was talking about how, you know, where everybody went. I don't know, it was just things I never quite saw, and it was always a different perspective. And then he was talking about his own work, why he did Flex Metallo, why he did Doom Patrol. you know, why he ended up doing All-Star Superman.
He waxed poetic about All-Star Superman. And I got to tell you, one thing, the major thing I got from his book is just an even richer appreciation for superheroes after hearing his enthusiasm about it and his take on the superhero genre. Like, he was very inspiring.
Yeah, and he taught a lot of personal stuff, too. It was a really... I found that book in Oklahoma at a used bookstore, and the only reason I bought it is because Dallas loves Grant Morrison. So I bought it for Dallas, but, and I don't mean to seem like a jerk, but if I buy a book for somebody and you get it, I already read it. I got a book for somebody for Christmas. Oh, when I finish it, I'll let you read it. Oh, you don't need to bother.
I already read it. Nobody never asked you to buy me toilet paper.
From now on, sealed books only.
But it's a really strong.
Don't buy a wrapping thing and do it.
It's a really strong book. I enjoyed the book more than I've enjoyed his other work, and I really liked All Star Superman. But it's strong, and there's a lot more to it than what we're going over.
He basically broke it down. He broke the book down into four sections, and as he was chronicling the history of superhero comics, it was also chronicling his life. That's why it's half autobiography. Mm-hmm. But so four sections. He's got the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Dark Age, and the Renaissance, basically. Where the Golden Age is the Golden Age, the creation of the idea of the superhero, you know, Superman, Shazam, Batman. Silver Age, of course, is the science heroes, the 1950s and 60s. The Dark Age was the 70s and the 80s and early 90s, and then the Renaissance would be the current era. It was really good. I would recommend it to anyone that has even a passing interest in superheroes, because it's so, like I said, it was inspiring.
But is he only talking about superheroes?
Just that that's the whole idea of the book. Not just comic books or not just the medium, but superheroes, that genre in particular is what he focuses on.
He does. He discusses Conan.
Yeah, he talks about other things, and he talks about even some of his non-superhero work, like Invisibles.
Yeah.
But the main theme of the book is superheroes and what and their place in our culture,
because
modern culture.
Because the more I look back on comics, and I could be wrong on this, Don, correct me, superheroes started out at the beginning.
Yeah.
But after the war, there was like a lot, and during that, there was a lot more going on than superhero. To me, the real superhero era was when the Silver Age came, and then it just took over everything. It's like it is now, even though there are still a lot of other, you know, things going on. But superheroes died.
But what happened? It was World War II, because comic books just they went up so many times because all the people overseas are reading them. And that's why you started getting like the comics in the Philippines, because American GIs would carry the comics, leave them somewhere, and that's when the Filipinos started making their own. Same thing in Europe and everywhere else. But superhero comics were huge. And then after World War II, everybody came back home and just wanted to get back onto a domesticated life. And superheroes died. And there wasn't too much interest. They always published Superman and Batman.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that so much that it was that. During the war, they needed the superheroes.
Propaganda.
Yes,
it was
propaganda.
It was propaganda. They had
someone to fight.
Well,
know?
Not only that, but it was a way for guys in the trench to escape for a minute. You know, read through a comic. Once they got home, they didn't need that anymore.
Exactly.
They were home. They were the heroes.
You're absolutely
right.
Yeah, exactly. You're right, because they saw things that
they
never would have dreamed on when they went overseas. And they come back and...
Yeah,
you know.
But then they created all sorts of things,
too. Yeah, and I think what happened is some of those guys, you know, some of those guys came back and went, you know, I really enjoyed this. I want to recapture this. Much like what happened with motorcycle clubs over the years was the guys that needed that thrill from war. Well, these guys needed that escape. And they created that escape by creating the comic book companies that we know and love today.
Yes, and that's the thing. And the big resurgence in the Silver Age was most likely attributed to these artists and these creators that were children growing up with the Golden Age comics, and they were inspired by
the same guys.
As they grew up.
It was the same guys. They were all Golden Age artists, pretty much.
Well, the Silver Age started when Julius Schwartz went to DC and started doing all those... the science fiction type books, and then later they brought back The Flash, you know, as the Barry Allen. And then,
a lot of the artists started out as young guys
in
the Golden Age, and they hit their peak in the Silver Age, and that's why those comics were so great. Everybody was peaking. Kirby, Infantino, yeah. Toth, yeah. Wood.
So what really do you think caused the downfall, the Dark Age, as he called it?
Oh, you mean in the 50s?
During like the 70s, the 80s, and the early 90s.
Well, the first killer was in the 50s when they went and they clamped down on EC Comics for all the gore.
Well, yeah.
Well, I think you're talking about the comic book
code authority.
Dark Age, yeah. A.K.A. the Bronze Age.
Yeah, the Bronze Age.
See, I don't consider the Bronze Age a Dark Age.
Well, I didn't either, but Grant Morrison did.
I'm just going off of what Morrison coined it.
From his perspective, why did he say it's a dark age? Basically, the way he considers it and why he calls it the Dark Age is this is when a lot of the Brits came over, like Alan Moore and a lot of these writers that were, and Frank Miller too, these writers were treating these characters in a more realistic light where they're trying to explain the unexplainable.
Well, that was the end of the 70s,
into the late 80s, exactly.
Because to me, the 70s, the Bronze Age, was started, in 70, 71? It probably started when Kirby left Marvel.
Yeah, well, the Bronze Age, they say, started when they let Gardner Fox go.
Okay.
When Gardner Fox was gone, they brought Kirby over to do his fourth World Series. That was the beginning of the Bronze Age.
But see, to me, that era was a new resurgence of a Golden Age. Because that's, I think, I could be wrong, that's an era when the fan artists started coming in. Robinson, Jones, Kaluta, Starlin,
To me, you're talking about a time frame when, you know, they were trying to explain the unexplainable, but they were writing these incredibly deep and introspective pieces, you know? Yeah. I mean, they were no longer just fanciful writings of idiots, as most of the world saw. You know, they were deep, they were introspective, they were humanizing pieces that turned these characters into not just, you know, da-da-da-da, but, oh, shit, I gotta get up and do what, you know?
Yeah.
Well, they kind of legitimized these characters in the eyes of people that didn't read comics, too.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
yeah,
these,
you know, so I don't really think it's fair that he calls it the Dark Ages.
Well, I guess he's speaking because the Brits came over here and maybe darkened the books, they got darker
maybe.
You know, the thing is, I like some of it. I really like Dark Knight. I like Watchmen.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like those. And I like things when they take on, you know, some of Howard Chaykin's stuff tends to do that. And I love it. I just don't like it when everything has to be dark.
Because
that's not how life is.
No.
You still want some with a sense of humor. I mean, Frank Miller can do the most horrifying things. And when you read it, for some reason it works and it's not repulsive. Other people try to do that. I guess it was like, what was that that singer that did that weird dance, MC Hammer.
And can't touch that.
Yeah.
I'm dying to know what the correlation is here.
Well, because
how do you connect those?
He shot up real quick, and then all of a sudden his career just downturned. So he shaved his head and he called himself Hammer, trying to be this, you know, gangster rapper. And that's kind of what happened. After Frank Miller and you know, Alan Moore did their works in the early 80s, all of a sudden, everybody was doing that. They're all shaving their heads and doing gangster rap. And it doesn't work for everybody.
I totally get the connection now. That was beautifully done, I got to say.
Well, I changed it because you put me on the line. Wait, I got to come up with something good.
You started to connect the dots between comic books and MC Hammer. And I'm sitting there going, how in the hell is this going to work?
His original intent, he was just going to talk about how much he loved Hammer.
To me, in the 70s, it's kind of like in the 60s, 50s, 40s, everybody read comics. I think in the 70s, it's when it started shifting towards fans.
Well, there was a direct market in the 70s.
In a way, if you look at the 70s, you know, you're talking about a time frame that, you know, fancifulness was not, you know, all that, you know, it was frowned upon in many ways.
Yeah,
you know?
In a lot of ways. Yeah.
I mean,
it was darker, grittier.
You know,
60s were
people
over.
Were expected to be serious. Quit being a kid. Grow up. You know, and even into the 80s, oh God, the 80s were horrible about that, if you think about it. You know, I mean, you're talking about the decade of greed is good, and, you know,
the me
generation, and, you know, the 80s, so, you know, during that time frame, you're talking about kind of a time frame where, you know, certain, I mean, take a look at Star Wars came out during this time frame that we're talking about.
70s, 80s.
Star Wars was one of those things where, you know, at the time, what else opened around the time Star Wars did?
Wizards.
French Connection?
No, that was earlier.
All right. What else opened to the general public? Not Wizards, but the movies that came out at that time, none of them were fanciful. None of them were fantasy based.
Oh yeah,
like
I know that.
Yeah,
you know?
They're all noir.
Yeah,
mostly.
The art,
exploitation,
the art and entertainment of that time frame was serious.
Yes, and it was always.
It was not, you know, it was not hero based. It was not fantasy based. You know, so you know the '70s and eighties. You're talking about a time frame where you know some of this stuff didn't. You know,
I mean, Star Wars is a game changer.
Star Wars was a game changer.
Was a game changer.
But if you think about it, comic books were always there throughout that entire time frame.
And because mainstream comics have always kind of followed the mood of our culture, going on in our society, you know?
Yeah, they do, yeah.
But you're right, yeah, Star Wars was a game changer because they were hearkening back to the 30s and 40s and all
that. And technology-wise. I mean, they were doing technology with, like, 2001 and Silent Running and that, but the technology in Star Wars changed the look of sci-fi. That and
you're right.
Close Encounters.
But the thing with Star Wars
that
I always loved so much about it, it had a tribal feel, but it also had a lived-in feel. Like
yeah,
I never
saw
any science fiction at the time.
Yeah, it didn't feel like 2001, which was very clean.
No, it was an old school pulp.
Anytime you saw any science fiction show, everything looked brand new. Everything was real clean.
Yeah.
And Star Wars, I mean, Luke's equipment on Tatooine, it looked like it was 50 years old.
Yeah, it was all busted up. It looked like
it was all working
fall apart.
Well, it's always bullseye and womp rats in that T-16 Skyhawk.
It was like a serial or something.
But, you know, the Rebels, all their X-Wing fighters and stuff, it looked like real military hardware. It was working and worn out and, you know, greasy.
Well, around the same time as Star Wars, there was also, like, Dawn of the Dead and stuff like that. You got, and Exorcist and all that stuff, which wasn't really fanciful. It was gritty and down and dirty. And the 70s was the hangover of the 60s, kind of, in a way. And it was good. We lived there. We know it was a lot of good stuff.
We did,
but it was definitely like, oh my God, no more bright colors and peace and love. Now we got like dirty hair.
Well, kind of like what you're saying though. It's like, everybody during the 60s, everybody went out and got drunk, and the 70s was the hangover where it's like close the windows, turn the music down. It's too bright. Oh God, my head hurts.
Well, and sexual revolution stuff happened in the 70s too.
Yeah, 70s was always recessions and oil crises and stuff like
Cold
that.
Cold wars.
A lot of shortages.
Porn.
But also
manufactured drugs. Yeah. Oh, I missed the 70s. No.
Bell bottoms and disco and some good hard rock.
That was the later 70s.
Some good hard rock in the 70s. And prog rock, and Genesis and EOP and King Crimson and all that. Yeah. You should have been there. We remember it.
Wasn't born.
Remember it, but people that are older than us don't remember it. I guess they were really living in the.
Of course, now that I was a kid, people our age would be saying, too bad you guys weren't in the 40s, man. That was just the best. Big bands, World War II.
That's true. They were the greatest generation. Yeah. They won the war, man. They won World War II.
Thank you very much.
Here's a question for you. You belong to a specific generation or specific time frame. When you actually can't remember that much about it,
exactly.
You were there.
Exactly.
One thing that threw me, you talk about World War II. When I was growing up, I know you can say this, there was a huge generation gap between my generation, we were kids, to the parents. And we all like rock and roll. My parents, it was always country, western, gospel, that type of thing. And they did like rock and roll, but it was... Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley, that kind of stuff. And they always talked about it. Bob Barker used to have a show called Truth or Consequences. They'd always have these things about generation grabs. Yeah. And they were huge between, the World War II generation and ours.
Yeah, and the teenagers in the 50s,
When I started noticing a big difference is when I moved here to Florida in 87, there was a 19-year-old girl that worked with me. And at one point, we found out that she just started liking the Beatles. It's when the Beatles came out on CD, and I think her husband got one, and she was surprised at how good they were. Now, this woman, she loved Eric Clapton. She was all into the Steve Winwood and all these bands from the
70s. Traffic and all that stuff.
She knew a lot of this, Jimi Hendrix, all this stuff, but she never would listen to the Beatles. And the reason why was her parents were shoving that down her throat, trying to make her listen to it. And when she said that, it's like the gears in your head stopped turning. It's like, well, I can't process that. Because my parents, they liked some of the songs of the Beatles. They knew them. But to them, the Beatles were a later thing that they didn't understand.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's so weird, your parents like it. Well, I started noticing there's not that big of a generation gap between later generations. And this guy I worked with, he'd always bring books in for me to read. And one was that guy Studs Terkel.
Yeah, I remember him.
His name is Studs?
Yeah, Studs Terkel.
Awesome. Probably a nickname.
He wrote a book in the 60s, real famous, about walking around meeting people and talking. What he does is oral histories. So basically, he takes people's stories and puts them in a book. Well, he had a, I can't remember the name of the book, but it's an oral history of World War II. And he's basically, it's mostly American servicemen and the women, you know, from the 40s, that civilians, servicemen, whatever. But he does talk to some German people, you know, they were in Germany during World War II. And I read the book, and one thing I started noticing was it was a real, they all went through hell together. The whole world went through hell. It didn't matter what country you're from, they did it together. And when I finished, I told the guy, that's why there was a generation gap. And he said, yeah. And I said, because the later generations didn't have a gap like that. He says, no. He says, I never realized why, but it was World War II. Because all those people went through World War II, and the rest of us came along, didn't know what that was about. And, I mean, there's always a slight generation gap here and there, but now, you know, kids and parents, you can all share some of the same music. I mean, you're always going to find your own. But it was a completely different world when Al and I grew up because we didn't go through World War II like the other people did.
Well, the difference between the World War II generation and the teenagers of the 50s is big, too, because they went through the war. The guys came back and they started having the suburbs and a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
And then the kids started getting, the teenager became like something that they catered to. They made movies for teenagers now and they made all sorts of, so that kind of started that thing. And then when the Beatles came along, then the teenager became really big. So from then on, it's been kind of like they catered to a certain generation. I think that's one of the big generation gaps, you know, when they started changing from just like radio or swing music or whatever, like, hey, you got your old folks' music and you got your young kids' music now. I think it's been the same since. But then again, maybe not, because like you said, some parents, you know, oh, yeah, I remember listening to those guys. And, you know, I don't know. It's weird the way things are changing these days, but what does it have to do with comic books?
Well, I've got something I want to talk about right now.
Little Nemo.
What?
Oh, that's
what they're redoing.
That's
Little
beautiful.
Nemo. Yeah,
well,
look who it's drawn by.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd point this out.
Eric
Who's Eric Shanover?
So go ahead.
It's written by Eric Shanover and drawn by Gabriel Rodriguez, who did Lock and Key,
we talked about
earlier.
Eric Shanover's good.
Now, I've seen this on Facebook, and I was shocked because it has a feel for Winsor McCay. If anybody knew, there was an old comic strip in the turn of the century called Little Nemo in Slumberland. And it was done, written and drawn by Winsor McCay quite well, I might add. And the draftsmanship in it was just par none. But it had a really strong Art Nouveau feel. And it's a comic strip that people this day talk about, and it's always been a high watermark. This is the first time I've seen anybody even attempt. I've seen Little Nemo homages and, you know, comic covers, which I've always enjoyed. But this one, it's strong. I'll tell you, Gabriel Rodriguez can draw some architecture.
Was Winsor McCay doing hallucinogenics? I know there was talking, it was called Dreams of a Rare Bit Fiend. Welsh Rare Bit was some kind of a food that you ate, and supposedly if you ate it at night, it would give you strange dreams.
Yeah, that was
something like that.
I have some,
I know,
right there at that page. He's talking about how Gabriel Rodriguez can really draw some beautiful architecture. What's funny is one of the first pages I opened up to it is a two-panel spread, and it's got like a pyramid-esque, a Big Ben-esque. I mean, it's got all these beautiful, beautiful buildings.
It has a globe in the wall or something, which I just
I mean, it's just absolutely gorgeous. I mean, look at that. Look at that drawing.
Yeah, I know. I'm
that's
looking at that.
Yeah,
beautiful.
What they did in it, because in the comic strip, it always started off, the princess needed a playmate. So they were sending somebody to get Little Nemo. And he'd go and he'd you know, be floating in the air. His bed would grow legs and, you know, crawl across the city. They're trying to take him to Slumberland. And then something disastrous had happened. At the very bottom page, he'd fall out of his bed. And it always says something about, Nemo, did you fall out again? Or something like that. Well, in this, it was like every two pages with that. They'd send somebody over. In Little Nemo, it seemed like it was the first year. Yeah, what's neat is he's showing, they're showing the diagrams, and also has the script that Eric Chanel wrote notes about, try to do this and try to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice package. And this is just the first issue of it.
Now, well, and you know, one of the things with his art is, you know, in the Lock and Key books, the house itself is a character. You know,
yes.
It really truly is a character unto itself. And, you know, you can see in his art, I mean, he is so detail-oriented. Beautiful.
This is incredible. Now, Eric Chanoweth, he's really got a penchant for fantasy, surreal style.
He did the Oz
imagery.
Books, right?
He did the Oz books with Scotty Young, another one of my favorite artists.
Before that, he did books in the 80s, though, the Oz books in
yeah,
the 80s.
Yeah, Eric Chanoweth, I think he
and
did
he drew
some.
Them.
Oh, I did not know that.
He
I
drew
knew
them,
the ones,
too.
The recent
yeah,
ones, he did all the Oz books
yeah.
in graphic comic book form with Scotty Young drawing them.
Well, the first time I saw him, I think it was First Comics in the 80s.
Yeah, it was.
And I think they were graphic novels, but they were Oz books, and he's a good artist. But there's something about his artwork, it's strong and it's precise, but it's missing that fire that I see in some people. I don't know why I say that. I don't want to put him down because he's fantastic.
You hold your tongue.
I know. Well, I don't mean to say that. Every time I saw the artwork, I said, that's really nice. But it's missing panache that I go for sometimes. Then Mobius did the Airtight Garage. Well, later, I think it was Epic, put out a series of the Airtight Garage, but it was drawn by Eric Chanoweth, and I think it's written by Eric Chanoweth and one of Mobius's managers. And he's basically expanding on the whole Airtight Garage type thing. And it was actually pretty good. And I think he's done some other. I think he's doing Age of Bronze or something for Image Comics, or had. But anyway, I noticed he works with other artists. He works with Scotty Young on the Oz books. He seemed like he loves fantasy, but he certainly has the feel because just the stories in these, basically what they're doing is the same thing. They're sending the same people out to get Nemo, but it's another kid. It's not the original Little Nemo.
It's a new Nemo.
And they're talking about when they tell the princess they found somebody, and she said Nemo. She goes, oh, I remember. Because I guess they could never find a playmate that was really suitable. And she says, I remember Nemo. I says, I miss him a lot. But I was really surprised. It's its own thing. When you read it, the first, every two pages is another person coming to try to get him, and then he falls out of bed. But it's not like just a stock standard, oh, we've done this, formulaic. It's kind of neat.
This looks incredibly good. I might have to pick this up.
I picked it up. I was in San Diego recently, and there was a store in San Diego I absolutely loved called Comic Kingdom. It took up a whole shopping center. The store was gone, but I heard there was another store there, so when I went, I haven't been to San Diego in 28 years. And I went and found it. It's called On Comics Ground, and it's just one space. But it's a fantastic space. I walked in there, and it's just nothing but a maze of comic books, and she has everything under the sun in there. And so if you're in San Diego, I do recommend dropping by On Comics Ground, and that's where I picked up Little Nemo. So win-win.
Nice.
Win-win.
Very nice.
All right.
Anybody else got anything? Or
no, I mean, we've been going at it
all
for
right.
a long time, I think. We need to... Oh, you want... Oh,
oh, oh wait, Don, pull out some more. So.
Wait a minute.
Here we go. Oh,
no.
Oh,
also,
done.
While I was there, I picked up Alan Moore and... can't remember the man.
Kevin
O'Neill's Nemo, Roses of Berlin.
Sweet.
And the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, you know, Captain Nemo's daughter... you know, took over, and I guess the second book?
The second
third
book.
Book. Yeah.
Was it?
Maybe it was the...
Oh, I didn't read the second one, so it must have
yeah, been. I never read the second one. I guess it's the third one. But, anyway, she took over as Captain Nemo, but she wasn't really in it much. She was in it a couple of times. But anyway, they did one little hardback book. It's kind of thin. Al's got it in his hand. It was called Nemo Heart of Ice. And it was a really clever story. I thought it was neat. The second was Roses of Berlin. It's basically, you know, Hitler's Germany. And it talks about her and what she's doing and everything else. I didn't like the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen when I read the first trade. After Ruckel Ennis, the Black Dossier, and I lost his 3D glasses, and I had to get another copy. I found it. I absolutely love it. But anyway, The Roses of Berlin, highly recommend. Heart of Ice, I highly recommend. So I guess he's going to be doing a lot of this stuff now that the story's finished.
Is this Nemo, Little Nemo, or is this a different Nemo than the Heart in the
Captain Nemo?
This is Captain Nemo.
Captain Nemo. Okay. Yeah. I'm getting my Nemos confused here.
Yeah, these
are
great.
Too many Nemos!
I'm just glad to see that Alan Moore is continuing the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen books. And with, thank God, with Kevin O'Neill, because it wouldn't be the League without Kevin O'Neill's awesome art. So
you know, he's an artist that I didn't like before, but I liked his work on these books. I didn't like him back in the 80s.
His older stuff in the, yeah.
Yeah, I was but I like it now. It works for these books. It fits good. You know? And that's the thing, too, with artists and writers. You know, sometimes you can get a great writer and a great artist, but the book doesn't click. But when the two people, there's a chemistry there, then it really works.
You're absolutely right.
I agree. I didn't like Kevin O'Neill either. I'd see some things he'd do, I'd pick up, you know, and I thought it was kind of neat.
So
I was never a huge fan, but when he started doing the, after I read past the first trade of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I absolutely love him.
Here's an idea for a future episode, maybe the next episode. We'll reconvene about this. Let's figure out our favorite writer-artist combo, or the most powerful writer-artist combos that you can think of that have been through the history of comics. But on that note, we're going to end this episode. So guys, once again, thanks for hanging out, and it was nice we got to get together in our secret hiding place in Rook's back room.
So, not supposed to tell people.
So everyone can look forward to seeing another episode of Two Dimension Comics in about a week. So thank you everyone for listening to us, and take care of yourselves, and until next time,
read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A-Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops.